Prologue, Thoughts on a Frozen Pond. In the dead of winter, I like to walk on water, held above liquid depths of the nearby lake by a vast frozen plain. This ice demands respect. I look again, I listen again, attentive to any crack or yielding to my weight. When the surface is more solid than a hardwood dance floor and much thicker, I venture far. Even then, I hear the gloop, a distant blurp, a muffled gloosh, water undulating beneath ice and me. Sunlight appears to emanate from above and below on cloudless February days, raying through the crystalline lattice underfoot. With my eyes but inches from the surface, any sense of depth, of refracted distance, yields to a sense of motion arrested. Air bubbles halt in mid-ascent. White oak leaves descend as if on invisible steps, suspended for a season above the lake bottom. The recent past lies beneath me in these leaves, plucked and blown here by January's heavy winds. Inches away, they are out of reach. I kneel within the next stratum. Thoughts of time's passage always come to mind on such walks, thoughts of how memory of any form becomes inscribed in the land. The hills surrounding this lake and my home are worn remains of long vanished mountains. Glacial debris from the last ice age produces a rock crop in my garden each spring. Stone walls that 2 centuries ago bordered fields and pastures now thread the dark heart of forests. Lauren Isley wrote in The Immense Journey that human beings are denied the dimension of time, so rooted are we in our particular now. We cannot in person step backward or forward from our circumscribed pinpoints. I cannot touch a leaf encased in ice, nor can I feel the calloused hands that stacked these walls. Yet we make our lives among relics and ruins of former times, former worlds, and each of us is too a landscape inscribed by memory and loss. I've long felt estranged from time and place, uncertain of where home lies. My skin, my eyes, my hair recall the blood of 3 continents as paths of ancestors, free and enslaved Africans, colonists from Europe, and peoples indigenous to this land all converge in me. But I've known little of them or their paths to my present, though I've tracked long bygone moments on this continent from rocks and fossils, those remnants of deep time. The traces of a more intimate lineal past have seen hidden or lost. Yet to live in this country is to be marked by its still unfolding history, life marks seen and unseen. From my circumscribed pinpoint, I must try to trace what has marked me. The way traverses many forms of memory and silence, of a people as well as a single person. And because our lives take place among the shadows of unnumbered years, the journey crosses America and time. Come with me. We may find that home lies in remembering, in piecing together the fragments left, and in reconciling what it means to inhabit terrains of memory and to be one.
Thank you so much, Laurette Savoy. You know, that sounds like poetry. You read it like poetry, and yet you're a scientist. Could you talk a little bit about how you incorporate your writer's sensibility with your scientist's sensibility?
I would say I don't distinguish the two. They've always have been part of the same vision. Tracing memory has threaded my life and my work as long as I can remember. Remembering fragmented past into present. And geology is one form of doing it. Poetry and writing is another form. But it's all the same thing, trying to reconcile, as I said, what it means to inhabit terrains of memory and to be one. And I came to geology because, well, for many reasons, but one of them was because of early experiences as a child facing racism and learning early on that the land, whether it was the Grand Canyon or a river named Potomac, the land itself didn't hate, people did, and that the land itself preceded hate. And so I sought refuge in places, but also in the great antiquity of the earth itself, because it not only preceded hate, but it helped me understand that there was so much more than that. And I speak of experiencing hate because I was a child in the 1960s and first confronted the sense that I myself could be hated during the riots in 1968. And when you're 7 going on 8 years old and people reject you and you don't understand why, you have to reach for something that does make sense. And for me, the land did. And then as I grew up, I realized that the history of the land itself could be entered by understanding the pieces of the past, the rocks and fossils. And I worked with those, but I always worked with those with a sense of if I could understand Earth history, if I could understand the materials and structure of the Earth, that then would be a foundation for having a sense of place. And that foundation then allowed me to return to integrating or interweaving cultural history, human histories with that. So for me, they've never been separate. They've always been one piece.
I guess the difference I would see would be how poetry gives rein to metaphor and the imagination, and science is rooted in data. Is that ever a contradiction, or actually do they inform each other?
I think they inform each other. I would say that some of my colleagues would disagree, but they definitely inform each other. I often imagine an image, and I use this in class, of a wagon wheel, a wooden wheel that has the wooden spokes converging toward the center. For me, science or geological sciences, earth sciences, represent one spoke. Poetry represents another spoke. History represents another spoke. But for me, they're all converging together to a center of understanding. And I think I have resisted the borders and walls that disciplines can set up, that you approach one field by asking a particular question or using a particular type of data versus another that may be completely different in the way in which it asks the questions. But for me, the questions can be melded. And that's what I've tried to do in Trace, to meld them.
And you do it beautifully. Can I ask you just what kind of geoscience are you working on? What's your, you know, what's your special course of study, if there is one?
Well, I've really moved in my course of study to doing work in which geoscience serves a work like Trace. Mm. But the work that I've done before has been trying to interpret or reconstruct ancient environments on the planet through time using those clues, rocks and fossils, but also geochemical signals within sediments, the sedimentary rocks that contain rocks and fossils. So one of my major studies and what I did for my doctoral work was literally reconstructing the ancient ocean past that now is recorded in rocks that are in the Northern Rocky Mountains and in the Canadian Rocky Mountains. If you go to Banff or Jasper National Parks, Kootenai, Yoho, and down into Waterton Lakes and glaciers, they're all sedimentary rocks that have been thrust up on these great thrush sheets. But if you look at the details in those rocks, collect the fossils, collect the rocks themselves to look at their texture and composition, then you can tell a lot about how they formed, where they formed, and what ancient oceans were like in terms of their chemistry, in terms of their oxygen level, how life could be supported. And one of the big studies I did, part of the dissertation, was looking at an interval of time about 350 or some odd million years ago in geologic time between a boundary between the Devonian and Mississippian boundary. And it was a time when the ancient oceans underwent a huge catastrophe. In this part of the world, oxygen became depleted on the seafloor and life could not survive. And I'm measured from looking at the facies, that is, the aspects of the rock, going from limestones that are very much like Bahamas-like platforms. I mean, Club Med would have been there had Club Med been around, to the bottom literally dropping out in a black shale sea where oxygen was so depleted, life couldn't exist or only exist in a minimal extent. And then the bottom of the ocean became reoxygenated and life then returned. And so measuring from that Bahama platform to black shale to back to carbonates or what you find in Bahama-like setting, and trying to understand what caused such a huge, what geologists call an anoxic event. So that's one of the studies I've done. But really what I'm doing now is trying to understand how the history of the land in places, the structure of the land then influences human settlement, migration, and also human stories about the land itself and how those stories inform who we are and are taken in as part of human identity.
Do you have a sense at a time now when we are in the midst of such changes on the planet, anthropomorphic, climate change, talk about human migrations, a time of terrible crisis in human migrations and you know, changes in the sea because of carbon dioxide and the acidification of oceans. Do you have a sense of the future, in a geological sense? I mean, you don't have to answer this if you don't want to, but I'm just thinking, can you apply what you know about the past to some thinking or imagination of what might be coming up and how the Earth might handle it and recover?
That's a huge question, and I think that's a question worthy of a dissertation. And quite a bit of dialogue among not just scientists, but many people who are thinking about the future of the Earth. A term that was coined in 2000 that many people now use, the Anthropocene, refers to this current period where it seems that so much of human activities has altered Earth's cycles, has altered Earth's systems. And it is unprecedented. From, as you mentioned, the acidification of oceans to changes in what people call biogeochemical cycles, that is the cycling of carbon, the cycling of nitrogen, phosphorus and others, to global climate change itself, to fragmented ecosystems, the list goes on. The question I have is whether or not we, humanity, in a larger sense, can recognize how we must change the way in which we live on Earth and the way in which we respect Earth and realize that it's not just a stage that would allow anything to happen. Everything goes. I mean, that's the way we've lived with the Industrial Revolution and so on. But that today we really are at or beyond a tipping point where unless there is a vision of restraint, a vision of respect, a vision of responsibility, I really don't want to imagine the worst that could happen. And it would be essentially entering a world that we are guinea pigs in our own experiment, and we don't know the outcome of that experiment. It's really hard.
Well, Laurette Savoy, thank you so much for talking with us here. Your wonderful book is Trace, Memory, History, Race, and the American Landscape.
Thank you very much, Francesca.